This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at the history of women in flight as this year marks the 30th anniversary of women being allowed to fly in combat in the U.S. military. Now, a teenager died last week while working at a meatpacking facility in Mississippi. 16-year-old Duvan Tomas Perez suffered a fatal injury while cleaning a machine at the Marjack poultry plant. And earlier this month, 16-year-old Michael Schulz died from injuries sustained while working at a sawmill here in Wisconsin in Florence County. These are not isolated incidents. A recent report from the Economic Policy Institute identified over 600 active Labor Department investigations into child labor law violations. Those seem to be on the rise. Since 2018, the U.S. Department of Labor has seen a 69% increase in children being employed illegally by companies. Meanwhile, state lawmakers around the country have been proposing legislation aimed at rolling back legal protections for workers under age 18. Workers' rights advocates are sounding the alarm, including our two guests today. They say it's time to strengthen child labor laws and enforcement, not weaken them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed an increase in teen employment, maybe at your workplace or in your community? What concerns do you have about the state of child labor laws and enforcement in Wisconsin, around the country? What questions do you have about what's legal and illegal? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Terry Gerstein is director of the State and Local Enforcement Project at the Harvard Law School Center for Labor and a Just Economy and a senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Also with us, Reed Mackey, coordinator of the Child Labor Coalition and director of child labor advocacy at the National Consumers League. Reed, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Terry, you just testified to the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee this month. In written testimony, you wrote that, quote, our country is currently facing a child labor crisis. Now, people might hear a phrase like that and think, well, maybe 100 years ago, but today, a child labor crisis. What is unique about this moment?
Well, what is happening, that I agree, it's very, very surprising. It's something that I think many of us had thought was from the history books and from a century ago. But in fact, as you mentioned earlier, the U.S. Department of Labor has seen a 69% increase in child labor violations in the past 5 years. And state labor departments have also seen an increase. And these include violations of, you know, our child labor laws have two main areas. One, it relates to the hours that children can work so that they don't have to work, you know, such excessive hours or like night shifts in a way that will impede their ability to get an education. And then the other set of laws concerns hazardous occupations, work that is so dangerous, that is like among the most dangerous work that adults can do. It is prohibited for employers to have children do them. And so we're seeing increases in both of these types of violations. And in addition, there's been some media reporting in the New York Times and Reuters and the Boston Globe and elsewhere about some really extreme cases, including teenagers working in sanitation in meatpacking plants or in Hyundai supplier car manufacturing companies. And so these are things that I think for a lot of us just really, in addition to being illegal, you know, shock the conscience and are something that, you know, need to be taken very, very seriously.
And Reed, I know in your organization, you watch for efforts to change laws in states around the country. What do you have your eye on? What are you concerned about as some states anyway look to loosen up some of the regulations on child labor?
These protections were hard won and they took a long time to enact, and we don't like to see them weakened, carelessly by state legislators. And you know, we have in the last, this year alone, we've probably had, you know, 8 or 9 states that have looked at weakening protections. Last year, we had 2 states weaken protections. And as Terry said, you know, some of these incidents involve, some of these efforts involve extending the hours that teens can work. And we know that's dangerous and impactful on their education, because academic research suggests that if a teen works more than 20 hours a week during the school week, that their grades start to drop and their school completion starts to plummet. So we definitely want to keep the teen work week under 20 hours. The federal level is 18. Federal protection is 18 hours per work week, and we think that's that's an adequate protection. So we've also seen states allowing kids to work in hazardous work areas like industrial laundries and meat coolers. And, you know, some of these bills actually had like more ambitiously destructive, regressive ideas of letting kids work in meatpacking loading docks. You know, some really horrible ideas out there.
Terry, apart from the laws on the books, can you talk about enforcement? How much actual enforcement activity is there to make sure that the laws we do have aren't broken?
So I think the U.S. Department of Labor, as well as some state labor departments, are really focused on this and taking it very seriously. But they have been systematically starved of enforcement resources for decades. The Wage and Hour Division is the unit within the U.S. Department of Labor that enforces the child labor laws. It also enforces the minimum wage laws and overtime and prevailing wage and the Family and Medical Leave Act. So it has a whole host of different responsibilities. And to cover the entire country, they only have about 800 investigators. And that's 400 fewer, roughly, than we had in the late 1970s. And when you think of the extent to which the economy has grown, you know, in the decades, it's really, really grossly insufficient to do the job. And state labor departments also are very much understaffed. And so I think that they are taking it very seriously. The U.S. Department of Labor, for example, recently announced a settlement, including in a child labor case, in which they used the hot goods provision, which is this special law that allows them to kind of freeze goods that have been illegally been produced with illegal child labor, freeze them so they can't go in the stream of commerce. And they used that tool to get a settlement in a case. So they really are putting a lot of time into this. They filed a big lawsuit against Packer Sanitation, which is the sanitation company that was employing teenagers to clean meatpacking plants in violation of the law. And they did a massive investigation where they visited, you know, half a dozen or more different factories in half a dozen or more different states and did it in the middle of the night. And, you know, they're really, really taking it seriously, but they simply don't have the resources that are commensurate to the scope of the problem.
Talking about child labor laws and enforcement around the country, Terry Gerstein is with us from the Harvard Law School Center for Labor and a Just Economy, and Reed Mackey with the Child Labor Coalition and Director of Child Labor Advocacy at the National Consumers League. You could join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Your thoughts on this issue, the number is 800-642-1234. Reed, there's an effort to change the law in Wisconsin in 2021. The state legislature passed a law that would extend work hours for some teenagers. You urged Governor Evers to veto that bill, which he ultimately did. One of the arguments at the time, I think, was, hey, we have this labor shortage. We have teenagers who want potentially to work more hours. If their parents are okay with it, why not let it happen? What was your argument against that at the time?
Well, I think I already mentioned it. You know, we know that if kids work more than 20 hours a week during the school week, that there's a good chance that their grades will drop. And they may not finish school, they may not graduate, and that has lifelong repercussions. We don't want to see kids sacrificing their futures, you know, for temporary gain. And I think Governor Evers made the absolutely right choice. If you have to balance a labor shortage on the backs of vulnerable teen workers, there's something wrong.
Terry, can you talk a little bit about the cases, these tragic cases we've seen in Wisconsin and Mississippi, 16-year-olds working in, I think, what are agreed to be fairly hazardous workplaces, a small sawmill, a meatpacking facility in Mississippi. What do those tell us about the state of labor laws, child labor laws in the country?
Well, yes, we have had, in the past, there was a 5-week period in which there were three 16-year-olds killed on the job in three different states. One was in a landfill, one was in a sawmill, and one was in, I think, a poultry processing facility. And again, as I said, there's this list of occupations, of jobs that are the most dangerous occupations for adults, and they are prohibited. It is prohibited for employers to have kids miners working at these jobs precisely because they're so dangerous. And they weren't just sort of randomly chosen. They were chosen based on data about workplace accidents and injuries and fatality. And so when, you know, people might, you know, I don't know what is the thought process of someone who assigns a 16-year-old or hires a 16-year-old to do these kinds of jobs or to work in these kinds of workplaces. But I think people really need to understand, employers need to understand that this is something that can cause, you know, this is not, this is something that is genuinely risky and that can cause death. And if you're the employer, you're going to have to live with that on, apart from the legal consequences, you're going to have to live with that on your conscience for the rest of your life. But in terms of legal consequences, you know, there have been some criminal prosecutions. I was previously the Labor Bureau chief in the New York Attorney General's office, and we brought a couple of prosecutions involving kids who were minors, who were, one was killed on the job, a 14-year-old who was killed working on a farm, who'd been working with a skid loader, which is prohibited. And we brought a criminal prosecution as well involving an employer, a teenager whose arm had been severed, and he was working with machinery that was prohibited for a child that age. And I know the Michigan Attorney General just obtained a guilty plea involving a case where there was a minor's hand was amputated. So there is a potential, many states do have criminal provisions. So there is the potential for very serious consequences for employers when these kinds of events happen.
We're talking today about the state of child labor laws nationally and in Wisconsin. Terry Gerstein is with us from the Harvard Law School Center for Labor and a Just Economy. Reed Mackey from the Child Labor Coalition also with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of protections do you think are most important when it comes to youth participation in the labor force? Did you work as a teenager? Do you think the protections that were out there were what you wanted to see? Do you employ teens? What kind of work are they doing for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Terry Gerstein from the Harvard Law School Center for Labor and a Just Economy and Reed Mackey from the Child Labor Coalition about the state of child labor laws in the country, recent efforts by some state legislatures to roll back child labor protections. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences in the workforce at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Reed, I was reading some of your testimony in some cases. One concern you've raised elsewhere is that these younger workers might be more vulnerable to mistreatment by employers. Can you talk about that concern?
Well, I do think, you know, that younger employers, you know, they have less, like younger employees have less experience and they have a desire to please their employers. It may be their first job. And I don't feel I don't think that they're empowered to express their safety concerns. So if they're asked to do something dangerous, they may go ahead and do it. You know, we saw a teen in Wisconsin trying to unjam a sawmill recently, one of the deaths that Terry mentioned. And, you know, he didn't exercise the proper safety precautions, didn't shut off the conveyor belt, things like that. He probably just didn't even know that he should be doing. So, I think that kids, teenagers particularly, are very vulnerable to getting hurt, especially new employees. A lot of accidents happen in the first, you know, the first day and the first week of employment. So it's just a very precarious situation and kids shouldn't be placed in certain environments.
And Reed, staying with you and the issue of vulnerability, there's particular concern for migrant workers, people in the country legally or without permission, being exploited at workplaces. Is that something you focus on?
We're very concerned about that. You know, we know there were 130,000 unaccompanied minors that came in, into the U.S. last year. These are kids that are have a desperate need for money. They're trying to send it back home to impoverished families in, you know, Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico and other, you know, other countries. And they, you know, they feel like they must work. And I don't think that they know about, you know, the entire infrastructure we have of safety. And you know, they probably enter into like meatpacking plants not knowing how dangerous they are, you know, what conditions they'll find within them. And you know, we're very concerned about their vulnerabilities. And you know, those kids that Terry talked about earlier, and then that DOL found in the meatpacking plant, they were kids that, you know, went to school every day after working all night in the graveyard shift, you know, cleaning saws and other kinds of dangerous equipment, using pressure hoses, using chemicals that burned them. You know, just really extreme vulnerability. And then they try to go to school the next day and fall asleep. So we're very, very concerned about that population.
And Terry, you've mentioned accountability for people who violate child labor laws. One reaction I've seen in reading up on some of these is companies say, well, of course, we don't want to employ people illegally, but we work with an employment staffing service. And well, it looks like they got it wrong here. What are your thoughts on that kind of companies distancing themselves from the responsibility here?
Well, that's something that we've seen over and over again, that, for example, some of the major meat corporations, like large multinationals, the biggest meat corporations in the world, were using Packer Sanitation, and then Packer itself was using a staffing agency. And so this whole business model, where companies subcontract and then they use a staffing company or an employment company, employment agency, it's a way for the lead corporations at the top of a supply chain, the name brands that really do have the ability to impact violations and to prevent them. It's a way for them to distance themselves from responsibility, because they've insulated themselves by putting this other layer. What is so interesting that happened in the case involving Packer, the sanitation company, is that JBS, a major, major meat company corporation, they, after this all came to light, they actually created JBS Sanitation, and they're taking a number of these jobs in-house and not subcontracting anymore. And they have an agreement with UFCW, a union, to make them union jobs. And so, you know, there's no law of nature that corporations, say a meatpacking plant, has to subcontract for their sanitation. They can hire their own employees to do this and thereby ensure that the child labor laws are not violated, or they can exercise a lot of control over their subcontractors and really monitor them and make it clear if you have child labor violations, you are out immediately. And they don't do these things. And if we had laws, we do have laws that allow for what's called joint employer liabilities. You can try and go up the chain, but it can be challenged. As a lawyer, I can say it can be challenging to do that sometimes. You really have to have a very strong set of facts. While if we had ways to create really clear, easy, ready accountability up the supply chain, certainly for cases where there are repeat violations or widespread violations, in other words, when that lead corporation can't really say, I had no idea, because it's so widespread or it's happened over and over, I think that's something that would really, that liability for them would really incentivize them to clean up their house.
Let's bring on a caller. Rachel is with us in Milwaukee. Rachel, hi.
Hi. I wanted to comment that I feel like the child labor laws are really not enforced, particularly in slaughterhouses where they might have children that are from other countries working there. And I know in the case where the boy that just died in Mississippi in the chicken slaughterhouse, he was from Guatemala, and that particular slaughterhouse had a history of very dangerous working conditions and also recent deaths there. So it's shameful that, you know, that this happened. It should have never happened, and there needs to be more oversight, more enforcement, and more strict punishment, not just a fine, and they keep doing the same thing.
Rachel, thanks for the call. Reed, Rachel worried that we're overlooking this major industry with major problems when it comes to child labor. Is this a part of the economy that needs more focus?
Yeah, we've been worried about meatpacking since 2008, when there was an immigration raid in Iowa that found 50 kids working illegally in a kosher meatpacking plant. I think we're going to see more revelations about kids working in these settings. And, You know, I think that Terry's also right that we need to hold the ultimate employer more accountable. And that's something that DOL said that they would do in the future when they announced their meatpacking findings. But they didn't do it in the case of the investigation that, you know, that concluded this year. So we really need to hold them to that position and make sure that, you know, that corporate entities are held more accountable.
Thanks a lot for that call. Terry, in our last minute or so, what do you have your eye on most closely as states around the country are looking to change labor laws, in some cases loosen them up for child labor? What has you most worried right now?
I mean, what has me most worried is laws that would allow younger children to work in dangerous jobs. For example, in Iowa, Iowa passed a law that allows the state to exempt certain employers and allow them, if they get permission from the state, to have kids working in more dangerous workplaces. Now, the federal law still, you know, trumps the Iowa law in that case, and employers still have to follow the federal law, but I think it could be very confusing for employers. And I think what really needs to be done is strengthening child labor laws, putting more money into enforcement, having stronger penalties, both civil and criminal, as well as holding lead corporations responsible, and also potentially allowing child labor victims and whistleblowers to file their own lawsuits so that all of the enforcement, it doesn't have to come just from the government, but so that there is a way for workers themselves to file lawsuits. But I do think we need to strengthen the laws to make sure that kids are safe and able to get an education rather than weakening them.
We'll leave it there. Terry, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Reed, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Been talking to Terry Gerstein, director of the State and Local Enforcement Project at the Harvard Law School Center for Labor and a Just Economy and senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute, and Reed Mackey, coordinator of the Child Labor Coalition, director of the Child Labor Advocacy at the National Consumers League. We talked about the recent deaths of two teenagers working dangerous jobs and what their stories tell us about child labor laws and enforcement. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, wildfire smoke has brought a lot of attention to air quality in Wisconsin. Find out how we monitor for unsafe ozone levels and what it means when we find it. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. With the hot weather this week, your thoughts might be turning to ice cream. Mine did. We got some at home. But what is your favorite flavor? And what's Wisconsin's favorite flavor? The online shopping company Instacart compared flavor preferences by state. Now, you might guess vanilla would be the most popular flavor nationwide, and it is. But in this analysis, they look for flavors that are uniquely popular in each state where people liked it a lot more than the national average. On that scale, vanilla still topped the list in 21 states. But here in Wisconsin, the standout flavor is Moose Tracks. The original definition of Moose Tracks, vanilla ice cream with peanut butter cups and Moose Tracks fudge. One company owns the basic Moose Tracks name and concept, but they license it to different companies. So that's why you see different brands of Moose Tracks in the store. It's big in the Midwest. Wisconsin, Iowa, and Michigan are the only three states with Moose Tracks as the standout flavor. I can't vouch for the scientific validity of this report, but I plan to continue my own personal research into this important topic. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we dig into the 75-year history of women in the Air Force. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a nonprofit that helps families in the Madison area.
For many survivors of domestic abuse, finding affordable housing can be a challenge. And then finding furniture to fill that new space, that can be less of a priority. But as WPR's Gabby Vinnick reports, one nonprofit is providing families in Dane County with sofas, beds, and decor to turn their apartments into homes.
Jaisha?
Yeah.
Okay, she likes blue.
How about these?
Oh, give them those. Okay.
All right.
Oh, what about those pink light lamps?
Yeah.
It's a Saturday morning, and Felicia Denny is on a mission. She needs to find furniture for a family of two sisters. They need items like a couch, a bookshelf, and an end table. We're on the second floor of Denny's house. She and her mom are choosing furniture for a family she's never met. Their work is part of an organization she founded during the pandemic called Felicia's Donation Closet.
What we do is we fully furnish abused women and children's apartments when they move out of homelessness.
Denny and her crew of volunteers help make a family or individual's house or apartment feel like home. To date, they've furnished more than 50 apartments. What started with a potential couch for sale turned into a full-scale operation. She donated her furniture to a mother through a community shelter. And from there, the idea to create a nonprofit took off. Donations rolled in, demand soared. Denny has a full-time job, but she would spend hours driving and delivering furniture to families on weekends. And for Denny, the mission is personal.
I'm a survivor myself, and I just felt that I needed to do something back, give back to the community. Just from the experiences I went through, had I known that there were so many other resources out there, I probably wouldn't have stayed so long in some of these really horrible relationships.
At a storage unit in Wanakee, Denny is moving furniture and directing volunteers.
Okay, you guys want to grab this dresser?
Careful, hey, you're going to break that.
It's a canvas, come this way.
Denny says many of the women she works with have gone through hardships. Some are homeless, others have been raped. And she says when people finally get a job or their own apartment and come back to an empty home, it only makes it that much harder to leave the abusive situation.
That's when you always start questioning, did I make the right decision? Should I go back? Because usually the abusers would keep finances for them, and that's how they trap them.
Denise says that's why helping people during what is sometimes their most vulnerable moment is so important.
So we are that missing aspect to make that home a sanctuary for them. That way they know that they are making the right decisions, they are in the right steps, they are heading the right direction, they can just move forward and become, you know, the beautiful women that they are, that they deserve to be.
You guys might want to go the other way so you can turn it, like, come out.
Denny and her team eventually arrive at a Sun Prairie apartment and begin to unload furniture for sisters Jaisha and Jessica Edwards.
All right, it's kind of a tight squeeze.
After their mom died in 2015, the Edwards family bounced around from Chicago to Sun Prairie. Jessica says her family had been on the waiting list for a new apartment for over a year.
There are so many emotions going on right now inside of me. Like, I don't know whether to cry, smile, you know. I'm just blessed because a few years ago today, I would have never thought we would have been here.
And to top it off, their home comes fully furnished. As she looks to the future, Denny says the bigger the donation closet gets, the more families they can help.
I think when it really hits me is when we're there and then we walk in and we're done with everything and then like their whole house is filled of everything, that the moms get emotional, and that's like usually when it gets me. Because then I'm like, oh my God, don't cry. It's going to be good now.
WPR's Gabby Vinnick brought us that story on Felicia's Donation Closet in Dane County. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, it's a big event in the skies over Wisconsin this week. The Experimental Aircraft Association holds its annual Air Venture in Oshkosh. With lots of planes and even more people, one focus this year, women in aviation. Our next two guests are speaking at the event today. First, Michelle Curran, call sign Mace, was a fighter pilot in the U.S. Air Force for 13 years, completing missions across Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. From 2019 to 21, she was the only female pilot of the Air Force's Thunderbirds Elite Demonstration Squadron. After leaving the military, she founded the company Upside Down Dreams and wrote a children's book with the same name. She gave a keynote speech earlier today at the EAA event and appears this evening on the Women Venture panel. And she was born in Medford, Wisconsin. I talked to her yesterday after she'd arrived at Oshkosh. When did you first get the notion that, hey, I want to fly a plane?
A lot later than I think a lot of people expected. While I was flying for the Thunderbirds, I had a lot of interactions with kids. And so a lot of people would ask me if I was, you know, 20 years ago, if I was one of those kids. And actually, I grew up in northern Wisconsin. I don't know if you knew that or not, but I'm a Wisconsin native. And I just did not have exposure to really aviation or the military. I was only a couple hours from EAA AirVenture, and I didn't even know what was going on. But it was about halfway through college that I went and visited a military base, and I got to see a couple of fighter aircraft taking off in full afterburner. And that was kind of the first time I had had exposure to that. And it was just a pivotal moment for me. I got goosebumps. It was kind of one of those jaw-dropping experiences. And from that day, I was like, okay, how do I figure out how to go do that?
Now, fast forward, you were the second ever female lead solo pilot of the Thunderbirds. Can you, first of all, tell us what that means and what it meant to you to take that place in the group's history?
Yeah, so I flew for the Thunderbirds from 2019 through the 2021 season, so 3 years. And the team has been around since 1953, so this year is the big anniversary for them. And it was really an honor to be part of that legacy. And, you know, it was a lot of responsibility, I think, to be in such a public-facing position as one of only a few women, because the Thunderbirds' mission is really to inspire the American public and to, you know, recruit the next generation of military aviators. But for the little girls that were watching the air shows, for them to see someone that they could relate to and someone that looked like them was pretty powerful. And so it was really an honor to be able to fulfill that role. And as the lead solo, there's 6 jets that you'd see in the air show if you've ever seen the Thunderbirds fly. Mm-hmm. The one out front is Thunderbird 1. He leads the entire demonstration as well as the whole squadron of 130 people. But there's the 2 solo pilots that do kind of the maneuvers that make a lot of people gasp, like the head-on passes where it almost looks like a high-speed game of chicken, all the flying upside down, the high-G maneuvers, the really fast climb rates. That's all the solo pilots. And so the lead solo is the more experienced of the 2, and I was responsible for kind of all of the timing and communication and just coordination for our element of 2 aircraft.
Now, at any point in that stretch, from your first idea that, yeah, you wanted to fly a plane to hitting this pinnacle for pilots, for fighter pilots here, were there obstacles based on being a woman where people thought, what's she doing here?
Definitely at different points throughout my career. When I first decided I wanted to do that, you know, gender didn't really come into the equation of, you know, me making that decision. It was just something I wanted to do. I didn't really think that much about it. As I got into more of the competitive kind of training pipelines for the Air Force, it started to get highlighted to me quite a bit. And then as we got into these, you know, very competitive spots where we have a class of 25 people and only 1 or 2 fighter aircraft are going to be available for that entire class, it can get, these people are your friends, but it can also get kind of cutthroat. And that's when it really started to get highlighted to me by a few people in the class that there was some notion that I was going to get that spot because the Air Force was checking a diversity box, which is not something that they do. Like, the standards are pretty dang high and you have to meet them. And so I ended up doing well enough to get, you know, one of those 2 fighter aircraft. And then there was just kind of this feeling of responsibility where I had to set the reputation for any women that would follow in my footsteps. Once I was actually in the, you know, a fighter cockpit and I was in one of the squadrons. And I also felt like I was under a microscope, right? Like, I wouldn't say people are waiting for you to fail, but people definitely are paying attention to what you're doing. And so that can be a little bit, you know, extra stress on top of the already stressful career. But by the time I got to the Thunderbirds, I definitely saw it as an asset because of what I mentioned. I could relate to, you know, all the women and girls in the audience in a different way than my male peers could.
Talking to Michelle Curran, call sign Mace, longtime fighter pilot in the U.S. Air Force. Female pilot, solo pilot with the Air Force Thunderbirds Elite Demonstration Squadron in Wisconsin for the EAA Air Show. Now, Mace, you've taken up another step in your career now, children's book author. Can you tell us about Upside Down Dreams?
Yeah, so my first kids' book, Upside Down Dreams, just came out in July, so very recently, and it really has great reception. It's been a bestseller on Amazon, and it's just been really cool to see all the photos and the reviews, you know, roll in of all these kids reading it. And it was a long process. The idea for the book came to me in 2019 when I was visiting the Smithsonian Museum in D.C., and then I didn't have time to actually start working on it until the pandemic when a lot of our air shows were canceled. And then it took me another 2 years to, you know, find a publisher, actually get it out in print. So kind of a 4-year journey. It's a passion project because I just got to have so many cool inspirational connections with kids in person, where I could see kind of that light bulb moment happen for them when they saw, you know, a woman doing what I was doing. And so I wanted to be able to continue to reach and inspire kids in that way once I was no longer flying for the Thunderbirds. And that's where the book kind of came into play.
You were able to fly with the Thunderbirds in your home state of Wisconsin. Now you're at EAA in Wisconsin. What does it mean to you to take your career, to take your love of flying, your message for the next generation back to your home state?
It was just really special every time I get to come home. And, you know, I did the Milwaukee show. It was just really cool. I got to have a lot of my friends and family there, which is just such a neat opportunity to be able to show them, you know, what I was doing at that point in my career. And then to come back to Oshkosh, I was here last year for the first time ever, which was surprising to a lot of people because, you know, I grew up just a couple hours from here. So having never been to Oshkosh until after leaving the Thunderbirds was a little bit of a shocker to the aviation community here. But once I came here, I was like, I have been missing out and I need to come back. And so I'm keynoting this year, doing book signings, part of a forum, and it's just really cool because I know a lot of people watching are kids from small towns in Wisconsin, and I think they can see themselves in me, and that can be really impactful for them to chase down whatever their own goals are.
Well, Mace, have a great time back in Wisconsin, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Michelle Curran, call sign Mace. I talked to her yesterday. From 2019 to 21, she was the only female pilot on the Air Force Thunderbirds Elite Demonstration Squadron. She's speaking today at the EAA Air Venture in Oshkosh. Coming up, we'll hear from another pilot and speaker at that event who wrote a book about the history of women in military aviation. That's up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk about women in flight as the EAA Air Venture continues in Oshkosh. Now we're taking a look at the history of women in combat flight. Starting 75 years ago with the Women's Armed Services Integration Act, which allowed women to join the military. Other big anniversaries this year, too. 30 years ago, women started to fly combat aircraft. 50 years ago, women started to be trained as military pilots. Eileen Bjorkman is a retired Air Force colonel and author of the new book, Fly Girls Revolt, the story of the women who kicked open the door to fly in combat. Eileen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You share this big history. You are part of this history. A lot changed from when you first joined the Air Force in 1980. Can you talk about your personal story, first of all?
Yes, so I came in the Air Force in 1980, and women were just starting to come in larger numbers. They'd started training as military pilots in 1973. The Air Force started training women as military pilots in 1976. And so there was still a fairly small number of women that were flying at the time. I couldn't go to pilot training because my eyes weren't good enough, and I actually found a loophole in the combat laws where I could fly as a flight test engineer, and I could fly in the back seat of fighter aircraft because they weren't considered combat planes. They were considered test airplanes in the test business. So I was actually able to fly in some of those aircraft in the mid 80s, and then had a front row seat to watching all of the laws change and the policies change in the 80s and the 90s.
What was at the center of that change? Who took the lead in making the case that women can fly, including flying combat missions?
I think what's really interesting about that is it wasn't a single individual. There were lots of different women who were involved in that fight from starting actually back in the 1960s. There was a woman, Jean Holm, who was very instrumental. She was a two-star general in the Air Force eventually. She was very instrumental in opening additional roles for women. She knew combat was a bridge too far in the 60s and 70s, but she continued to advocate for women even after she retired. There was a group called the Women Military Aviators, that was the small numbers of women military aviators that did exist. They came together. They started writing to their congressmen and their leaders and explaining why the laws really needed to change. And then there were several congresswomen that were very supportive as well. Patricia Schroeder, in particular, comes to mind. So.
Now, you are speaking at Air Venture. You're sharing your book. You're on a panel, I think, later this afternoon with a group of women, including Mace Curran, who we just heard from. What kind of things are you hoping gets out there to this this big audience at Air Venture?
So they're going to hear a little bit about the history, not too much, because the focus is on the women who've actually been able to fly in combat. But yes, we're going to hear from one woman who was in the Air Force in the mid-80s when women were not allowed to fly in combat. She's going to talk a little bit about her experiences, and that's General Jackie Van Ovost. And then we're going to have the first three women fighter pilots in the Air Force are going to come in, come on and talk about their experiences as the first women and what it was like for them. And then, you know, a little bit about their first experiences in combat. And then we're going to bring in the younger women like Michelle Curran, Mace Curran, and they're going to talk about how things are today and some of their more recent experiences. So it's going to be a little bit of a history lesson and a little bit of, you know, where are we today? And just emphasizing to everybody that, you know, women can do anything in the military now. You know, there really are no limits.
And Eileen, you're making the case for more women in aviation. And included in that, you know, we think aviation, we think you're flying the plane. Hang on, you wrote a piece that appeared in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel talking about the need for more mechanics in aviation. And one of the things you say is, hey, we've got this untapped potential of women getting into aviation mechanics. Can you talk about that side of the industry, military and civilian?
Yes. So women are very small numbers, even in the civilian side of things. As I mentioned in that article, women are only about 3% of mechanics. And so there's, like I said, there's a huge untapped resource there. And for airline pilots, only about 5% of women are airline pilots. And so, again, there's a huge untapped resource in this country that, you know, that we need to use if we're going to have a very strong, you know, be a strong leader in aviation, which we are.
How important is it for you to have role models front and center? I mean, your book traces this chain of, you know, people who inspired the next generation to advance a little further. How important is just like seeing someone, maybe for that young girl in a small town like Mays was talking about, seeing someone in aviation potentially being that inspiration?
I think it's important. You know, I didn't have a lot of role models when I was in, obviously, but there were women that I knew about, like Jean Holm, that I think, oh, she could do it, you know, I can do it too. And I have heard lots of stories of people telling me about their experience of seeing a woman and then all of a sudden realizing that, oh, I can do that too. I heard one story about a little girl that I think it was here at Oshkosh. She came to Oshkosh with her family, and there was a woman with her T-38, woman pilot with her T-38 here, her training airplane, you know, standing by the airplane, and she saw her and realized that I could be a pilot too. So I think a lot of it is, you know, there's that saying, you know, you can't be what you can't see. And so I think having representation is very important.
Now, you served in the Air Force. I hope you don't mind if I bring up another branch of the service. We have a joint chief's nominee to head the Navy would be the first woman to head one of the branches of the military. How important is it for you to see that glass ceiling get broken?
Well, again, I think it's very important. You know, I think the main consideration is that she was the best person for the job. You know, she obviously has a background that makes her very qualified. But I think being able to, you know, put her up into that position definitely sends the right message to, you know, the American people and to the world, is that, you know, everybody in the United States has opportunities to go as far as they can and as far as they want to.
Now, in Fly Girls Revolt, you tell the story of women being able to take on more and more roles in military aviation. Are we at the point you want to be at right now, or are there still barriers to be broken, or at least numbers to be brought up?
So I would like to see more women in aviation in the military. About 20% of the Air Force is military. About 20% of the Air Force is women. You'd expect that about 20% of our pilots would be women, and we're nowhere near that. We're about like the airlines, we're around 5%, and it's even smaller numbers with fighter pilots. So again, I don't believe in quotas, but there are definitely barriers. There are things that are keeping women from either becoming interested in aviation in the first place, or they're leaving aviation because of family issues and things really that we can help deal with in the Department of Defense.
You're at Air Venture now. Are you seeing a pretty solid gender mix as far as the crowds turning out for the big event?
I am. I'm very thrilled with the number of women that I see here. We just had our picture taken today out on the flight line, and it was a huge crowd, and everybody's wearing their blue t-shirts today, and it's just like a sea of blue here. So I'm very pleased with the crowd.
Eileen, thanks a lot for joining us. Enjoy your time here in Wisconsin.
Thank you. I always do.
That's Eileen Bjorkman, a retired Air Force colonel, author of the new book, Fly Girls Revolt, the story of the women who kicked open the door to fly in combat. She talks about the history of women in the Air Force. She's speaking today at the EAA Air Venture in Oshkosh. Also tomorrow. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there's a lot of content for kids on YouTube, often unregulated and uncurated content. So parents don't know what they're getting and what their kids might get into. Find out what's out there, get some advice for parents, and some good alternatives for kids to watch that you can kind of trust and count on. And the Barbie movie is a big hit, and its main character has a pretty big history in American culture. We'll look at the impact of Barbie dolls from the early days to the big screen. Are you now or have you ever been a Barbie fan? Have you seen the movie? Love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, restaurants are bouncing back from COVID. According to recent national numbers, people are going out to eat, but restaurants still face some high costs. We'll check in on the state of the restaurant business here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.